This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 Chai FM.
And this is The Deep Dive, and I'm your usual host, Brooke Spector, Friday mornings at 9, and then repeats on Sunday at 10 on the same station, and of course available eventually on podcast. Regular listeners know we vary our tone. Sometimes we do international economics or the physics of dark matter or international relations or political conflicts, all manner of things like that. And sometimes we do other things that are a little better for the soul, I think. Sometimes we talk about art and music and film and theater. And I think everybody enjoys that as well, because these can be dark times. Things like this help elevate the tone and give us a feeling about life that it is indeed worth the struggle, worth the effort. And so today we're going to do art as in stuff that you hang on the walls or put on a table. And we have as a guest Willem van Rensburg of C. Strauss & Company, the exhibition and auctioneering company that deals with fine art. I have been to several of their auctions and sales and exhibitions. And one of the ones that sticks in my mind forever, partly because I have an enormous love for the work by the artist, you had an exhibition, two sculptors, Sidney Kumalo and Ezran Lachai. And as I sit in my living room, I see one of our pieces by Ezran up on our wall in a little sculpture niche. And it was a delight to see one other copy of that same casting was in your exhibition. And it's in fact in the massive catalog. And so sometimes we just wander over to see Strauss and Company to see what they have and to see exhibitions that they are putting on pre-sale, just to look at what people have owned and what people like during their life, and ultimately what ends up going for sale in the secondary market, those of us who didn't catch it the first time around. So, Willem, it's really a pleasure. You have a resume that is a meter long. You've taught, you have published essays on, you have conducted studies of, you've curated works. What was the most, thank you for joining us, first of all, but what's the thing that has been giving you the most pleasure in this varied career within the world of the arts?
Thanks for inviting me onto your show, Brooks. I think you said it at the outset, art for me is food for the soul. And I think that is what has been driving me. You know, people often say, you know, if you like what you do, you're not really doing any work. And I think I'm squarely in that situation, you know, starting from the teacher training I did. I trained art teachers at Soweto College of Education, later on at Johannesburg College of Education, and on to the Faculty of Art, Design and Architecture at the University of Johannesburg before starting at Strauss & Company. My wife and I also ran an art gallery called Art on Paper at 44 Stanley Avenue. And when she closed the gallery, I started here. So I have experience in what is known as the primary market, the gallery scene. And as the name suggested, art on paper, it was our first love. You know, when we were students, a lecturer looked at the two of us and said, you know, you people, I can see you like art. Why don't you start buying works on paper, prints, drawings, watercolors? And that's exactly what we did. And we accumulated quite a collection of those. And even today, you know, I'm naturally drawn whenever I'm at an exhibition. Invariably, I'm drawn to works on paper. And when my wife opened the gallery, you know, it was only natural to call it art on paper. So I think the educational side is very important in the secondary market because people often, I often come across people saying, well, I buy what I like. And I said, yeah, well, that's all good and well, but you also have to buy not only with your heart, but also with your head. And that is where I think art education is quite important because, people, I want people to be able to say, I bought this 1 million, 2 million, 3 million artwork, and this is why. I think I can imagine people sitting around a dinner table and people say, oh, I see you bought this painting. Why did you pay for it? 3 million. Why did you? Because I like it. And I think the response would be, So I want to go beyond that, so I bought it because not only do I like it, but because of this, that, and the other. And I think that is where art education comes in. So it's a combination of all of those things, my studies in art. I'm a trained art historian since 1977. I did art reviews for Bild newspaper in the 80s and 90s. So I met all the gallerists, all the artists at the time, and I still make a point of going to virtually all the exhibitions in Johannesburg. And if we have the time, Cape Town and Pretoria and the like. And I think all of those things come together to make me who I am today.
Well, you said buy with your heart and your head, but you inferred that there's a third place that you have to consider, and that, of course, is your wallet.
Absolutely.
But the reason why I mentioned that, not to contradict you, but to extend the metaphor slightly, the question obviously becomes, what drives prices? Why would somebody, to take the weirdest possible example, a banana fastened to a wall with a piece of masking tape is sold in a London gallery for reasons no one can quite understand, whereas an artist whose work is of enormous quality, anybody can see it, languishes for years until something happens, and then all of a sudden the price rises precipitously. What is this mysterious machinery?
So this is sort of part and parcel of the art market, and it is a complex creature, to say the least. And and the thing is that we look at when we value artworks, we look at what is known as an art price database. There are many of these art price databases around. We subscribe to all of them. It's not just a matter you type in the name of an artist and up pops an auction history with all the sales records and the like. You have to subscribe to those. And what I like about all of those art price databases, they generate an automatic graph for you, showing you the peaks and the troughs. And this is sort of getting towards answering your question. And sometimes I would get people saying, but I paid 500,000 rand for this particular work, and now you value it at 80. And I said, okay, sirs, madam, let me show you the graph. And did you buy it in 2011? Yes. How did you know? Because I said, well, that was a peak. And today, when you look at the graph, it is in a trough. So fashion changes. That's the main thing. You do get what we call blue chip artists in South Africa. They are the Pierneefs, the Prellers, the Sterns, the Kentridges and the like, and their work sort of consistently sort of accruing value over the years. For example, the highest value Pierneef sold in 1990 was 100,000 rand. 10 years later, it was 1 million. 10 years later, it was a 10 million. And so it goes on, and we at Strauss on our website, we advertise those 10, 12, 20 top artists who, if you buy them, they accrue in value. Now, you mentioned to answer the other part of your question, you mentioned the banana on the wall. So that is what we call contemporary art. Contemporary art is very different to what happened in art in the 20th century. That is sort of what we call, in art historical terms, the modernist period. Now, this is a quick 1 minute art history lesson. Modern art started in 1863 when those impressionists were kicked out of the French academies, and it continued to sort of the late 50s. So it's a good 100 years. That's the modernist period. Now, what happened with modernism was the shift from artists trying to recreate, sort of like on a two-dimension, what they see in front of them, a landscape, a still life, a portrait, or whatever, in three dimensions. So that was the pursuit up to that time, up to the middle of the 19th century, and so they perfected that, so they depicted historical scenes, biblical scenes, allegories, mythical subjects, and the like. And the Impressionists broke completely sort of away from that. And the emphasis was because art then perfected that sort of realism, that naturalism. There was a massive shift. They didn't have to. The modernist artists didn't have to do that anymore. They didn't have to try and replicate nature. They could express their feelings, and that is what modernism is all about, So you have the German expressionists, for instance, you have the cubists, you have the surrealists, and so we look at art differently when we look at modern art. We look at sort of like the formal elements, the expressive brush strokes, the flat surface, the level of abstraction. And for me, the logical conclusion of modernism was, two style movements, the abstract expressionism of a Jackson Pollock, for instance, and geometrical abstraction of, say, a Joseph Albers. Those are the logical conclusions. And then there's a shift. The shift in the 60s and 70s, and I'm talking pre-contemporary art, the 60s and the 70s, and that is what in art historical terms is known as the dematerialization of art, and then later on the rematerialization of art. What do I mean by that? The dematerialization of art is something like conceptual art. It is not a painting that you see on a wall. It is a concept. It is an idea. It is a word framed and hung on the wall, and people make associations and what have you. So conceptual art sort of dematerialized. It's not a canvas. It's not a piece of wood. It's not a piece of marble. It's not a print. Nothing of the sort. Just the concept. Rematerialization is when all of a sudden artists start using their own bodies. So you have body art, you have land art, you have performances, you have happenings. So sort of like it, art literally became alive, so to speak. And then in the late 80s, there was the shift to what is known today as contemporary art.
We're going to take a quick station break. This is the Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, I'm pleased to say, Willem van Rensburg of C. Strauss & Company. And we're doing a very quick tutorial of the entire history of Western art. And we'll be right back after these messages.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is the Deep Dive. I'm Brooke Spector, your host, and my guest today, Willem van Rensburg of C. Strauss & Company, senior arts consultant, analyst, observer, person who guides, does all these kinds of things with exhibitions. I stopped him just before the turn of the century in art, and he was going to wrap up with this because I have lots of questions. But you were on your way to explaining the conceptual art concept of the banana on the wall, which was rematerialized art with a, I guess, with a vague insensibility.
That banana is part of what we know, what we in art historical terms know as contemporary art. Contemporary art is a different kettle of fish. It's not realism. It is not expression of feeling. It is issues based. It deals with issues of socioeconomic issues, the issues of the environment, identity politics, and the like. So often you would need an explanation combination of an artwork. You know, often people ask me, what am I looking at? And then you say, oh, this portrait is actually dealing with identity, identity crises, identity politics, gender issues, and the like. And so the banana is sort of like referencing consumerism, for instance. But I think the main thing there is about sensation. It is a sensational aspect. Everybody, the whole world knows about that, and it lands in the history, the writing of art history, of global art history, because it is so different, because it is such a major shift, you know. And I think that is the whole thing. The same thing happened with the Banksy that after it was sold was shredded in front of you know, the audience, the sale room in I think it was Sotheby's in London. The same day, it's the pure sensation, you know. People pay millions for it, but they get recorded, their particular artwork. It's not existing anymore. Can you imagine what that banana looks like today? You know, so, but it's pure sensation. They get sort of listed, recorded, documented, archived as the collector who had this very novel, sensational sort of piece of art.
What you've said intrigues me with the following question. When you're talking about art which requires explanation, which requires an essay to go with it so you know why in the world you're looking at it kind of art. And yet one of the blue chip artists you mentioned in the beginnings of our conversation, of course, is the very well-known William Kentridge, whose art is not conceptual in that way. It's in many ways very realist. Whether it was film or whether it was three-dimensional work or whether it is dance mixed with video, mixed with art, it is, yes, it has lots of concepts layered into it, but it is also, you know, even someone who's not skilled at this business can look at it and say, I see that. I understand. I'm not sure I understand it exactly, but I certainly see it. And he is not out of the business of creating art. He's still very, very active. He's younger than I am, certainly. And it continues to pour out of his very fertile imagination. But let me add, that's part A of my longish question. And my second part is the artist Irma Stern, whose work now is selling at astronomical numbers. And as my wife likes to remind me, was one of the first artists to examine the life of people other than, shall we say, other than white people in a way which was not particularly condescending, but which was descriptive. If it was fishermen in Zanzibar, she painted fishermen in Zanzibar. If it was fruit sellers in Cape Town, she painted that without trivializing the pursuit. And yet her work continues to rise in value, and it is easy enough to take on board what it is she's doing. Those are just two examples, I think, from different eras, but they trump conceptual art in a way.
Indeed. Now, let's start with William Kentridge. Now, when I talk about the modernists, the subject matter that those artists deal with announces itself. You know, when you stand in front of a painting, you know, you look at a landscape. When you stand in front of a Maggie Laubscher still life, you know what you're looking at. When you stand in front of a portrait by those people, you know what you're looking at. What the question, the thing that you have to deal with was, how is that subject matter expressed? Is it vigorous brush strokes in a very expressive style? Is it geometrical? Is it abstracted? And all of those questions, but you have the image in front of you as a guide. Now, when it comes to William Kentridge, sure, certainly you can recognize still life, some of his latest works. You can recognize an iris, but what I mean by, and I want to call him sort of also a conceptual artist, not necessarily a modernist artist. When you look, for instance, at one of his irises, yes, it's very pretty. Yes, it's very beautiful. Yes, people are prepared to open their wallets and pay a lot for it. But I think there's much more to that. And that is where the explanatory, the explication part of it actually comes in. Because sometimes, you know, a couple of years ago, somebody asked me, now, what is this iris and William Kentridge? Why on earth would you do that? Here's the reason. The first time he painted that he used that iris was in a actually a performance piece. It was called The Return of Ulysses in the late 1990s. You know the story, you know, the return of Ulysses, 10 years at war, 10 years on the way back to Penelope and what have you. And how he conceived of that was those 10 years would all be in Ulysses' mind. So Ulysses, and this was all done by puppets, by the way. Ulysses was on a gurney, in sort of like a delirious state of mind, semi-unconscious and what have you. And at the back, is projected images that flashes through his mind. What are those things? You know, he's worried about Penelope and the three suitors and whether she's going to be faithful to him and whatever. And at some point, there is a cross-section through his skull, projected now, of course, in William Kentridge's iconic type of drawing on the screen. You see the four lobes of the brain, and then all of a sudden those four lobes morphed into the shape of the iris. So the iris is really then a symbol of Penelope, so to speak. Few people know that. You know, they just think, oh, it's a lovely iris. Oh, it's Dutch iris. He gets it from sort of Van Gogh, Vincent van Gogh. He gets it from Albrecht Dürer. Not the case. You know, it is actually a symbol of, often in his video work, you have these creatures morph, you know, telephone morphing into a cat. And here you have the four lobes of the brain morphing into sort of like an iris. And I think the point I want to make is that people often miss that. Yes, the subject announces itself. You have a beautiful iris. But if you have the symbolism, you know, the relevance behind that, then all of a sudden it becomes much more.
That's very 16th-centuryist with those Dutch paintings where the flowers and the this and that and the other things all have symbolic value to the viewer in the 16th century. And now we look at
Exactly.
it and say, what in the world is this skull doing on the dining table?
Exactly that. You know, I will never forget, I saw one of the most beautiful, and it was a very small and very modest exhibition at the National Gallery in London. A dispute about, you know, the authentication of an Albrecht Dürer painting. I remember it was the Madonna and Child, and in the foreground, that was the beautiful part. There you have all these different types of weeds, flowers, and the like, including that iris. So I will never ever forget that thing. And you are absolutely right. They all have these, they're imbued with symbolic value. I think Kentridge then sort of taps into all of that. But of course, it gives it not only a mythological dimension, you know, in the case of Ulysses and Penelope and what have you, but also sort of relevance for us today. Emma Stone, I'm glad you mentioned her. And yes, she depicted a sort of a people now. They're of all sorts of color and what have you. And the interesting for me is that initially, she of course painted the Jewish intelligentsia in Cape Town. Those were her supporters, her best friends, her doctor, her cousins, her nieces, and the like. But she, you know, she was sort of like a quite, for want of a better expression, a restless soul. She was sort of like became impatient, I think, with a confined set of subjects around her. And so she started traveling. Now, the interesting thing is this started happening in sort of like the 1930s. That was the time, you know, when things in Germany changed fundamentally. With a new political dispensation. Remember, you have to remember, you know, her parents lived in Germany for a long time. That's where she studied, that's where she trained, that's where she had her first exhibition. That was sort of the cultural world. In the 1930s, she changed her attitude towards Germany and Europe sort of fundamentally. And basically, she said that people think of Africa as a dark continent, populated by savages. The real savages are actually in Germany. Okay, and I am going to travel through Africa and I am going to show people sort of what Africans really are like. And that is when she went to the Belgian Congo, she went to Dakar in Senegal, she went to a stone town in Zanzibar, and she went there frequently. And she painted, she hired models. And I like your comment, that you mentioned that she depicted the Hasidic personalities. Often people say, Irma Stern just appropriated them, and then she made them sort of the exotic other. It's not the case, so she knew those people, she paid those people, she didn't give it a name. For instance, it was Miss So and So or Mr. So and So, but that is sort of like besides the point. I think the personality of the person, the sitter, actually came through in her work, and that is what we see today. That you mentioned they go for sort of tens of millions of rand. Yes, we sold one last week or a week or two before for 21 million, and it is one of those sitters that she painted on one of her visits to Zanzibar. So also, I think the other aspect of Stern is that she was basically on her own, woman alone in the 1930s, in the 1940s, packing her bags, getting her car onto a train, going to sort of like Elizabethville in the then Congo, and paint, or getting on a ship and disembarking at Stone Town and paint. So it's quite phenomenal as sort of like as a woman. She was sort of like feminism way ahead of her time. The first wave was in the 60s, the second wave in the 90s, and so on. And she was way ahead of all of those things. And I think people begin to appreciate and realize that.
We have to take a quick break. This is the Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and I'm really pleased. Our guest today, Willem van Rensburg of C. Strauss & Company. And if you came in at the beginning, you are well on your way to having a Bachelor of Arts degree in the theory of contemporary art. You're almost there. Just stay with us a little longer, and you'll finish up, and we'll hand out the certificates. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is the Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today, Willem van Rensburg of C. Strauss & Company. Sometimes we do international relations and international economics and the chaos inherent in them, or we talk about physics, or we talk about literature. But today we're doing art. Art, the stuff that makes you feel better about yourself, or makes you think, or makes you puzzle. And at just before the break, we were discussing the astronomical rise and rise of the works of Irma Stern, and that inevitably brings us to the question, which has arisen in the last little while, about the Irma Stern Museum in Cape Town, which has, until it closed the other day, wonderful collection of her work and her things in situ in the place that she lived when she wasn't traveling, and now suddenly it's history. What happened?
I think it is such a tragedy, because that is really, if you want to talk about South African heritage, South African art legacy, that is an absolute prime example. We have hardly any, in fact, we don't have any what is known as house museums now. That is what it has always been, sort of like the number one house museum in South Africa. It was after her death, the house and its contents, including all the art, was bequeathed to the University of Cape Town. The museum itself opened in 1971, and it has been going ever since. Sort of, I think from what I can gather is that the upkeep, the maintenance of the house is actually becoming quite vastly expensive, rising damp, and sort of wood rot and what have you. And so I imagine it would have cost quite a pretty penny to renovate the whole place. And I think the university didn't see their way open to go to all those expenses. And so the idea was that a bank expressed interest to buy the whole property and to do the renovations, but I think they changed their tune as well. And so the big question now is what would happen to the collection? They have absolute prime pieces in there. I curated a big retrospective exhibition of Irma's work in 2003 at the Standard Bank Gallery in Johannesburg, and I literally went through every single nook and cranny, every single drawer, and I saw the hundreds, thousands of drawings, watercolors, gouaches in the collection. So it's actually quite vast. Also, all her the stuff that she collected, you know, traditional African figures, textile objects, chairs from all over the world, from her travels that she amassed in her house, that she often included in, especially her still lives, with mats and carpets and figurines and vases, the Martabani she got from Zanzibar, and the like. And for us, whenever we have an Irma still life, it's always very interesting to see if we can locate the exact image there. So, what's going to happen to all of those things, you know? So, it's all good and well to move it to the waterfront, but you cannot replicate, you know, the actually wonderful atmosphere of the house itself. She actually built in, you know, she got doors, picture fr window frames, door frames from Zanzibar. I think probably not always legally, but she put it on a ship. She took it to her house in the first Rosebank, Cape Town, and she often would frame her pictures, you know, very important paintings. She would use those doorposts and window frames, wooden window frames, all carved sort of in calligraphic style and the like. And she would use those to frame her paintings, and those paintings often would fetch much higher prices. So, what's going to happen to those, you know? So, it's all good and well to sort of dismantle a door, double-sided door, and put it up in some or other high-rise building on the waterfront, but to what effect, you know? So it's, for me, it's really a tragedy. The Irma Still Museum has always been on the international itinerary of international visitors. So it's not as if there were no visitors, you know. Obviously, there could be more, but it's not necessarily going to be, there are going to be hundreds of thousands of visitors in the waterfront flocking to it. You know, we look at Zeitz-Mokka at the waterfront. It's not necessarily teeming with, it's very important for contemporary African art, but it's not always teeming with international visitors. So I don't buy that argument, you know. So I am skeptical about what the intention is with the collection, and I sincerely wish that it could remain as it is, of course, given all the expenses and the vast amounts to restore that place.
The events that came to my mind, I'm thinking back in Washington at one part of the National Gallery, Whistler's Peacock Room was collected in its entirety, right down to the floorboards, and
Absolutely.
carefully reinstalled there with the art, with the chairs, with the wall sconces, the whole bit, at who knows how much expense it took. But now we're going to have to break for a second. This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. My guest today, we're having a wonderful conversation about art. You've almost got your BA if you've been listening to this point. Just a little more with Willem van Rensburg from C. Strauss & Company, and we'll be right back after these messages. Don't touch that dial.
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
This is The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector. My guest today, Willem van Rensburg of C. Strauss & Company. And we have been engaging in a really heavy-duty art tutorial. And if you have been taking careful notes, you are ready for the exam. No, all kidding aside, this is fun. I'm actually learning things. I now know more about the iris in a William Kentridge work than I did up until about an hour ago. And I'm pleased to know this. I'm going to go look at the symbology and all the other pieces by Kentridge we have around this house, try to figure out what they mean as well now. If I don't understand them, I'm coming back to you to say, what does this thing mean? One of the things that we need to be fair, you have an upcoming exhibition and sale and auction of some pretty heavy-duty contemporary modern South African artists. I don't want to say quite contemporary because I guess they're all pretty much not with us anymore for the most part. But you have one person who got my attention, somebody who, when I first came to this country in the 1970s, very few people were interested. And that, of course, was George Pemba. And by the late 1980s, he'd suddenly become recognized for the vitality and the color in his work. It was pictorial. It was scenes of life. It wasn't emotionally deep, but it was vivid and it was vital. And it was, above all, cheerful. People seemed to be having a good life in his pictures, or if they weren't, they looked like they were trying to. And that now his work is moving into the upper levels of sales, along with the Prellers and the Sterns and the Kentridges and the Pernifs. Tell me a little bit about this exhibition stroke sale auction that you have upcoming.
Okay, so Brooks, there are basically is what we call auction week here at Strauss. We have four auctions lined up. The first one would be on Monday, the 17th, and that features 15 William Kentridge drawings. Drawings, a very interesting story, because they were commissioned in 1985 by the Mobil Petroleum Company for their headquarters in Cape Town, and they asked him to do wildlife. So it's not often a subject matter we associate with him, but he depicted rhinos and warthogs and cranes and leopards and cheetahs and the like. Really, really delightful work. And some of these images then recurred in his subsequent works, like the rhino in the magic flute that he produced, staged and directed and the like. So that is on Monday, the 17th. On the 18th, we have our two conventional sales, what we call the day sale from 2 o'clock, and then the evening sale. And that is the day sale, basically wonderful works, but sort of, I would say, so below 100,000 rand. You can get something there. And then the evening sale is, of course, what you call the big hitters. And that's where you find the Pembas, the Sokotos, and the Prellers, the Pirniefs, and the Sterns. And then we have on Wednesday, the 19th, a very, very special sale. That is the collection of African art by well-known Anna Starker. Now, she was a legend in her own time. She came to South Africa from Germany in the late 1950s, first Cape Town. She married the artist Helmut Starker, who taught at the Michaelis Art School for many years. And in 1970, she moved to Johannesburg, where she became a journalist working for the Financial Mail. And she started her own company, but she amassed a fantastic collection of sort of African art, you know, traditional African art, but also what is known as the colonial period, the colon figures of the 30s, 40s, 50s, basically bought from the well-known Vittorio Meningeli, from the Meningeli, Toto Meningeli galleries. But apart from that, she was interested in mid-century modern furniture and also sort of art, pop art by the likes of Joe Tilson, so we got basically we cleared her apartment in Killarney and we recreated it here in a wonderful exhibition at our showrooms. You are most welcome to come and have a look at them. And we got specialists to value this because we've never offered traditional African art, and so we are very confident that that would do very well. But coming back to George Pemba, very interesting story. He grew up in the Eastern Cape, Port Elizabeth, specifically Brighton. You remember it was segregated at that stage. And he was basically self-taught, first working on paper, watercolors. We have two of his portraits on the sale. And when he met, he won sort of like a what was then known as the Department of Bantu Affairs. He won a scholarship, so he traveled to Cape Town, to Johannesburg, and the likes. And in Cape Town, he met, of all people, Gerard Sokoto, who said to him, "Listen, George, if you want to be taken seriously as an artist, you better start painting in oil. Leave the watercolors alone." And so we're also very fortunate to have two of those wonderful water oils on sale. Now, the interesting thing was he was really taken up with the Art Association in Port Elizabeth and East London, specifically Dorothy Kay from that area, and she made sure that he was invited to all the functions. And I'm talking late 50s and 60, early 60s, you know, when it was very segregated, not quite high up apartheid, but sort of segregated. And she made sure that he was taken up and that he was appreciated, but it was regional, only in sort of the Eastern Cape. It was only in the early 1990s, with a big exhibition at Everard Reid Gallery that featured his work
I
very
remember that.
prominently,
Yes,
and
indeed.
that is when he made a name for himself in the general art circuit, the general artwork in South
He was
Africa.
still alive then. He was at the exhibition. I remember meeting him.
There you go. There you go. You know, so, and basically his art falls into two categories, the traditional Xhosa culture that he captured there, and the life of the people, and then also the plight under apartheid, you know. So one of the works, for instance, was a rugby match in Port Elizabeth, broken up by the police. And so it was very real, you know. It was not sort of like it was the front page photograph that he painted, so to speak. And that is what you say, you know. His work is colorful, and the daily life in the Eastern Cape. But you always see that undertone of sort of suffering. But I think the human spirit shines through, you know, the spirit to conquer, to overcome, and the like. And I think that is what I appreciate about Pemba.
Well, unfortunately, my wallet doesn't stretch quite that far. Although I would make wall space if I could arrange it for one of those works, but that's not going to be for me. But this has been a wonderful conversation. I've really enjoyed it. And everybody who's listened all the way through till now, write in, let us know. We'll send you the BA certificate, and you can come. Give you the gown and the ribbons and the whole bit. But we've been speaking with Willem van Rensburg of C. Strauss and Company about art in general, about why art works for people, about why it works for artists, obviously, and collectors, and the exhibition stroke auctions that they have coming up in the next several weeks. And it has been a true delight, and really wish we had more time because I had lots of questions left, but we're not going to get to them today. We'll have you back again at some point in 2026, and we'll talk more, and we'll look forward to that. This has been The Deep Dive. I'm your host, Brooke Spector, and my guest today was Willem van Rensburg. Willem, please just very quickly tell us where C. Strauss is for those people who don't know.
We are very conveniently situated at 89 Central Street in Houghton Estate, just off the M1 South. And we are open the whole week, 8:30 to 4:30. And next weekend, the 15th and 16th, we open the whole day for viewing, the Saturday and the Sunday. So up to now, all the showrooms are beautifully hung, and people are welcome to come straight away.
We barged in a couple of weeks ago when you folks. folks were busy trying to hang things, and we kept tripping over work, and you all look rather aghast that we're wandering through, but we'll come back and we'll look at them now that they're hung.
Certainly, it looks beautiful. Yeah.
Our guest today on the Deep Dive was Willem van Rensburg from the C. Strauss & Company. And again, thank you very much for joining us. Listen again on this program if you want to hear it again on Sunday at 10. Otherwise, it's podcast and you can hear it anywhere in the world. And we look forward to having you join us again next week for another conversation. Be safe. Have a good weekend.